Hi, this is Peter Gethers. I'm the author of My Mother's Kitchen, and as you learned last week, I'm taking over the Clever Cookster podcast for the month. Thanks to host Kara Rota for introducing me. And this week, I'm interviewing Joan Nathan, author of 11 cookbooks, including her brand new book, King Solomon's Table, a culinary exploration of Jewish cooking from around the world. She is a regular contributor to the New York Times and Tablet magazine, and I'm a huge fan, so I'm incredibly happy to actually be talking to her. So hello and welcome.
Well, thank you.
I have several questions that I've been wanting to ask you.
Uh-oh.
And we can vary, but
okay.
First of all, I did a little bit of research, and you have two master's degrees, mm-hmm. one in French literature and one in public administration.
Correct.
How in the world did that translate into a career in food?
Well, actually, the French was very natural because I've used French throughout my whole career. And I remember when I lived in Israel, I was lived there in 70 to 72 working for the mayor, Teddy Kollek, who I'm sure you've heard of.
Actually, some people I haven't. Actually met him.
Ah, well, good.
Yeah, he was delightful.
And he didn't speak any French. So the first job I had was to take a French TV crew around with David Ben-Gurion, who was very old at the time. And Teddy had no patience for languages, for people from countries with languages he didn't know. So I used French all the time. But I also used it when I started writing cookbooks because I live in Washington, and the famous Jean-Louis Peladon first came and didn't speak a word of English. And I spoke fluent French, and it just, as a writer, if you can communicate in their language, it opens so many doors. So it's opened, and it also opened doors in Israel because I interviewed French people from Morocco, from Algeria, and I got their recipes, which is what I'm always after.
Very clever. I like it.
And the public administration, well, actually, it was a ploy to get a master's and to study at Harvard for a year. So I looked for every class, like food and sociocultural systems. Or I took a course with Daniel Patrick Moynihan on ethnicity and politics. And I said, could I write a paper on ethnicity and food? And he said, yes, if you want to.
So you knew right away food was the way you were going to go?
Right, exactly.
So interesting.
Yeah.
I wrote a play called Old Jews Telling Jokes.
Yes.
And one of the most interesting things I learned when I was researching it, this is a lengthy question to get to what I want to ask you, but was how Jewish humor actually turned into American humor.
Uh-huh.
Because when you think of American humor now, it is in fact so Jewish, Seinfeld
right.
kind of stuff. And the reason really was due to television, the networks needed time to fill. And they needed entertainers. And
absolutely.
Who were the entertainers, especially in New York? It was Broadway actors, stand-up comics, and old vaudeville people who were Jews, almost
right.
all of them. So around the country, in places where Jews weren't still allowed to buy houses and rent apartments and people who'd never met a Jew, they actually had Jews in their living room without really knowing they were Jewish. And it was this kind of sneaky way of getting the humor around the country.
Right.
So it was really interesting. And now American humor is Jewish humor in many, many ways. So my question is,
yes.
Jewish food in so many ways is American food. You go to people in Memphis and they're serving lox and bagels for brunch. How did Jewish food turn into American food over the years?
Well, a lot of Jewish food is Polish food or Russian food, and the Jews brought it over, and you're absolutely right, using vaudeville and other just actors and comics, Jews would make fun of their food. I mean, borscht belt, for example.
Good.
Borscht is Polish and Russian, but a particular kind of borscht, one was a dairy borscht,
right.
and one was a meat borscht, came over with the Jews. And then, of course, mother's borscht bottled it. And it got into lots of ads, too. You can't forget the ads and what you're talking about.
So it all boils down to TV and advertising, ultimately.
And there were so many Jews in the TV and advertising business.
Right, right.
So, I mean, I've thought about that a lot. Bagels, of course, when bagels and yaks that play in the 50s came along, nobody knew what bagels were before then. And then I remember when I was a kid, lived in Larchmont, New York, and at a time when Larchmont was not so receptive to Jews. And my father thought that the neighbor behind us was Jewish. So he said, you know what, I'm going to go to the Bronx and I'll get some bagels and I'll bring them and see if he knows what they are, they're Jewish. And if they don't, they aren't. Of course, they did, and they were.
Well, now that test wouldn't work because it's just so interesting. It's become a part of the culture.
Right. And also it's good food.
Well, I think that's the ultimate reason. It's the same thing with jokes. They were funny.
Right.
If they weren't funny, they wouldn't have become part of the culture. The food is good.
And but like I make it at home. I always make challah every Friday night. And I have a cleaning woman who comes in, and I've taught her how to do it. So she's from El Salvador. So now for Christmas, instead of she makes challah, and for every holiday, and also brisket.
Oh, gosh, that's really great. That's really great. Well, that actually kind of leads into the other question I was planning on asking, but it's a natural transition. So my family actually owned a pretty famous, in fact, extremely famous Jewish dairy restaurant called Ratner's, which used to be on the Lower East Side in New York. And I'm not demeaning my family, although I'd be happy to. But I grew up eating that food, and while it was really good, I would never call it fine dining. And I was in Israel 20 years ago, approximately, and I thought the food was horrendous.
You've got it.
Now, Israeli food and Jewish food is kind of the new Danish food. It's now considered really top cuisine. How did that happen?
Well,
it's still a little shocking to me, but it's true. But part of it's Otto Lengi and you and people who've elevated it. But
there are a few questions in there. But I think that as far as Jewish food being elevated today, that you're right. That I think that the cookbooks like Otto Lengi's or mine or a lot of others, where the food is just flavorful. And what it's done is, even though they don't like Israel, a lot of people, they somehow food is above that. And that I was in New Orleans at Alon Shaya's restaurant.
Which is incredibly good. Incredibly good.
And I looked at all these people. The Zulu king from Mardi Gras was there. You know, what did he know about Jewish food? But he was loving it. Then this other couple from, I don't know where, from Mississippi probably, were there just for the day. And the woman said, well, my husband wouldn't come because he thought it was a vegetarian restaurant. But they thought it was the newest food. And so that I think that what's happened is in the past 20 years or so, food has taken on such high proportions. People are interested in it. And it's no longer, Israel is no longer a socialist state. Or so-called socialists, certainly not with the government that's there right now. But so that people, I remember speaking to some of the chefs that were in the forefront of this, and they said, you know, when I was growing up, you weren't allowed to talk about food. This was a socialist state. Now, especially after the 91 war, they just like food. They like other things.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, when people like Chez Panisse went back to the land in the 70s, the early 70s, and what we did it in the United States, started to do it. They are doing that all over the world now. And eating is no longer fine dining. It's much more casual.
Right.
So, and it's just good food, good and also local ingredients. That's what we're all into.
Well, so your new book is about Jewish food around the world.
Correct.
So does that mean Jewish food has incorporated the elements you're talking about? So French cooking has snuck in and various.
Yeah. Well, what I mean, I think of Jewish cooking. Should I tell you what my definition of Jewish cooking
Please
is?
Please do.
Okay. Well, I think that Jewish cooking is, first of all, if you think about Italian food or French food, even though it's not totally true. The roots are in the land. I mean, every mm-hmm. food, even the French food, even though they won't say it, for sure, immigrants have played a huge role in their food, and so have they in the Italian food, even if it's from one village to another village.
Yeah.
And so, but Jewish food is different. Jewish food, we might think it started in ancient Israel, but it was so long ago that it's been wandering food. So the first thing I premise that I have about Jewish food is the dietary laws. Even if you don't believe in them, in the back of your head, you know that you're supposed to separate meat with milk. And there are those who are the diehard, the very religious, that really incorporate that into their lives. And it's something, but not only that, even if you're not that religious, like, for example, me, I incorporate Shabbat. I have Friday night dinner at my house, and I try to make the Saturday a little bit different day for me, more relaxing, whatever. But the point is that we all think about the Jewish holidays, and they're all have a food component, and a food component at the table. Mm-hmm. So that's the one thing that I think is very true about Judaism. And it's given us comfort throughout the centuries.
No, I think the only difference is food was always a big part of Jewish culture, only now the food's good.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the first thing. Second thing, I think, is that Jews have always, from the get-go, been merchants, like at the time of King Solomon. Mm-hmm. And they've gone around the world looking for the newest spice, the newest jewel, the newest stone, going to India, going all over the then known world. And that's been forever. But the third, and so they've always been in the forefront of the food business. It could have been for kashrut because right. they're bakers, but it could have been for meat because they wanted to make sure their meat was correct. People like my family was from Germany, and they always remember that a kosher butcher was always a clean butcher. So, but also the third component, I feel, is that Jews have always been kicked out of places. So if you've been kicked out of a country, you had to go to a new country and figure out your food. So it was regionalized, and Jewish food, taking the laws and bringing them to different countries, created new recipes or variations on recipes, and you know, and good tasting food. And I think that Jewish food had a bad rap because of all your jokesters. Mm-hmm. And it's more fun to make fun of food, you know, the overcooked yeah. whatever, until recently. And I remember even myself when I was writing Jewish Cooking in America, I said, well, you know, Jewish food has always gotten a bad rap. And somebody who didn't have the same vision as I did of Jewish food said, Jewish food is great. So, so those are the three components of Jewish food.
I'm convinced. That's really, really interesting. I think you're right.
Hey, guys. Kara again. Hope you're enjoying Peter's podcast takeover. Before we get back to the episode, a quick word from our sponsor. Did you know that saccharin was accidentally discovered because someone forgot to wash his hands? Or that fondue became big after World War II because of a big cheese cartel? If so, check out the funny and smart podcast Hungry Squared, hosted by Sharon Titus and Winter Red, where they talk about the nerdy side of food, food science, food history, and food design. Plus, they love doling out unqualified advice to listeners with food and relationship problems during their weekly food fight segment, like how to deal with the picky eaters in your life and whether you should eat dessert every day. So check out Hungry Squared on Stitcher, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Their latest episode, number 38, features Anna Curran of the online service Cookbook Create. She talks all about the history of cookbooks and how they reflect who we are. And now, back to Peter's podcast takeover.
And I'm not sure there's any really Jewish food, by the way. I think that if you go way, way back, it's all been...
I think that's, I mean, other than maybe French food, but I think that's really true. I spent a lot of time in Sicily, and I published a cookbook by this wonderful mother and daughter Sicilian team. And I know the daughter always said, there's no such thing as Sicilian food because basically they've been conquered by so many countries over the years. Every time they're conquered politically, they bring in a different kind of food. So Sicilian food is, it's basically North African food. It's very Arab. It's very French. It's very Italian, which Sicilians don't think they're Italian. But
and it's also Jewish.
Yeah, and it's also Jewish, definitely, right. So, all right, because this, I definitely have to ask you because the holiday is coming up soon. Uh-huh. So Passover foods, what do you love?
Oh, gosh. Well, I love chicken soup with matzo balls, but not too light. I like
you like
little al dente.
Okay.
I like good brisket, but I don't like the very sweet brisket. I like just with a lot of red wine in it.
For some reason, making brisket has always terrified me. I make a lot
it's
of things.
The easiest thing in the
I know.
World.
It scares me, and I don't know why.
Well, come to my house.
Okay, I'm going to try it.
Okay. I love all kinds of fresh salads. I like different. I always have five different kinds of haroset to show.
I love haroset.
I use it as a lesson. My kids go, oh, they roll their eyes. They're not kids anymore, but they still roll their eyes when I mention, you know, why we have the haroset. Probably all my guests do too. But,
I love it.
And I have in my new book, I have this wonderful new recipe from Ferrara, Italy, with pine nuts and chestnuts, and it's really quite wonderful. And it was a recipe that might have been, it was written, what's his name? Who's the person that wrote Finzi Concini?
De Sica?
Bassini.
Oh, Bassini. Oh,
Giorgio Bassini's family recipe that I got for the new book.
Wow.
It's really delicious. And then I have a blueberry haroset from Maine that people created. And then, of course, a nutless haroset and a Persian haroset, but from around the world.
This almost makes me look forward to Passover dinner.
Anyway, and then, of course, flourless chocolate cake. I always have that. And I just gather recipes from my family, from other families. And then this one new recipe I have, it's also in my book. It's a hard-boiled eggs that have been cooked like huevos jaminados, the Sephardic, very long-roasted eggs. And they're served, it's a recipe from Corfu, and it's the first course of your dinner. And it's served with spinach. And it is so delicious. Because in my husband's family, we didn't do it in our family, but they always had a hard-boiled egg with salted water. Did you ever have that?
Yes, absolutely.
So this new recipe has replaced that. It is so good. So if I find something that's really good, then it becomes our tradition.
Is there something in your book? Oh, sorry.
I forgot the gefilte fish, of course.
I like gefilte fish, but for me, it's mostly an excuse to eat really hot horseradish.
Absolutely.
That's my favorite thing. So looking for Jewish food around the world, is there anything that surprised you, or is there something that surprised you the most? Did you come up with a food where you went, oh, my God?
A lot of times.
Really?
And I also found new recipes, which I wasn't sure I was going to find. So, and the wonder of it. Let's see. Well, in India, for example, where I had really delicious
You're not going to say gefilte fish. Okay. Okay.
Chicken and fish, curried fish. Mm. It was just delicious that people made. And I was able to brighten it up sometimes, because sometimes a lot of Jewish food gets a little tired.
Mm-hmm.
So I brighten it up with fresh spices and fresh herbs. This egg with spinach really...
I'm definitely trying that.
Oh, that was so good. And I'll tell you the story. You might not want to use this, but my mother passed away about 2 weeks ago. She was 103 and went to Ratner's. And she, before I brought her my book, and I thought, oh, it's too heavy to bring to her. But, you know, at 103, you never know. So I opened I gave her the book, and she was too tired to read it. She went to sleep, and she called me in about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I was downstairs, and she said, I love your book. It's so beautiful. And then she said, and you started the book with my mother's recipe. And I thought, what? There's nothing of your mother's recipe in there. And she had a hard time with her mother, and her mother died many, many years ago. And it was that egg. She said, you know, my mother always made chopped eggs with onions and spinach. But I don't think she made it with spinach, but it was her way of reconciling a recipe with her mother and that her daughter would carry it on.
It's interesting. And by the way, at Ratner's, they definitely had an egg and spinach recipe, a chopped egg and spinach recipe. I remember
really?
It from my childhood really,
oh, my
really
God.
Well.
I'm going to look at some. I've got the old Ratner's cookbook.
Which my mother wrote, by the way,
really?
The Ratner's cookbook. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's in there.
Oh, Well, so, see, my mother was right because
yeah, your mother was definitely right. That's really good.
But so. And then there was another story I'll tell you that I
please
if the I from somebody in New York. Is it called the Hot Bread Kitchen? Anyway, it doesn't matter. But I learned about a recipe called Schritzlach, and which I had never heard of.
That sounds but like someplace you'd go for a steam bath.
And it was, they were blueberry buns, and it's from Toronto. And everybody that's from Toronto knows about these blueberry buns. And they're oblong, and they fit in your, you make them, and there's blueberries in them. You make them in your hand, and then you close them, and you bake them. And they're really delicious. And I'd never heard of them. So I looked them up, and I found that this woman came about the time in the First World War came to Toronto from Poland. And she had a bakery, and she made them. And then she put blueberry pie filling in them, or whoever took over the bakery did in the 50s when that was a hot new product. And they were awful. So then as I was testing them, trying to find a good recipe, taking a recipe that I saw and making it better, a young girl that usually stays with us when she's in Washington just popped in at my house. And she said, oh, my God, you're making Schritzlach. That's what my grandmother used to make.
Oh, my gosh.
So she said, but my grandmother's tasted better. So she not only was she able to find a recipe for me, but that was better. And I added a little bit more butter to the dough.
Well, that helps.
Yeah. But she found a memoir from the Holocaust of a woman remembering this blueberry bun and exactly described it perfectly. And not only that, the baker from Toronto and her grandmother came from towns 30 miles apart. So what I realized were these were both religious women. So that when the Holocaust came around, and I've often thought about this, the recipes that were lost, they rounded up people in Southwest Poland because so many of them, they were from little towns and they were religious. So you could tell by their garb or what... and quickly annihilated them. So that this recipe, because these women came before World War II, was rescued.
Oh, that's really incredible.
And it is. And there, and you can think about how many more were like that.
Thank you so much, Joan. I can't wait to read King Solomon's Table, A Culinary Exploration of Jewish Cooking from Around the World. It really, truly sounds amazing. For past episodes of The Clever Cookster, check us out on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, quickanddirtytips.com, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And don't forget to please check out my new book, My Mother's Kitchen, available from all book retailers. Thank you so much.